Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you retro sci-fi and horror cinema with Brian Walker of Brian's Drive-In Theater. Greetings and welcome. How are you, Brian?
I am well tonight, Hercules. How are you doing?
Okay. I had a very busy day, and now I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Great. And I'm really excited about tonight's topic, too. One of my favorite directors of all time. You seem to have a real affinity for Ed Wood and his output. Del Tenney, he was so much better healed than Ed Wood in terms of budget. money wasn't a big issue for Del Tenney. But still, you know, his movies are really no better than Ed's. but his movies are a whole lot of fun. He did a better job at crafting his films maybe than Ed Wood. They certainly looked more expensive. I will give him that. The editing was better. Sets were better and things like that. But he's still a really fun topic, and I'm excited to talk about it tonight.
And I'm excited to learn more about him. I think I might have seen a few of his films over the years. I was looking at his filmography before, and I love the titles, like Lloyd Kaufman of Troma and Tim Beckley of The Paranormal. He seems to have a way of finding awesome titles for his movies.
Well, and you know what? The title used to, well, today titles, I think, are either too literal or so abstract that it's just one word. You know, back then, you know, if you wanted to pull somebody in off, you know, the state route, you know, when you were trying to pack the drive-in, you needed a really catchy title, you know.
Right.
And Del Tenney had some great ones, and although, like I said, his output wasn't as he didn't make as many films as some other low budget horror directors, but he made some really memorable ones, and ones that people, they may not know who Del Tenney is, but I guarantee you they've probably heard the titles of the films. So the titles are actually really bigger than the films themselves. They really are. A lot of American International movies from the 1950s, some of them had some fantastic titles, but it was all ballyhoo. The movie, while it might have been fun, was really inexpensively made, quickly made, and not particularly well made. But they were a lot of fun to watch. And some of these films, I do think, have a certain amount of soul. You know, we've talked about this before, but if you're trying to, in the case of Del Tenney, in a couple of movies he made, he turned into sort of a double feature. That was really a Herculean effort, if you think about it, trying to pull out two movies and you've never made a movie before. He gambled, and like I said, he had access to money, so money wasn't. Ed Wood had to beg for every penny he got and didn't get a whole lot of pennies at that. That wasn't the problem for Del. Del married his wife. He and his wife were married for a long time. She was from a fairly well-heeled family. He had access to money. And Del had really started his career, probably better back up to that, as, initially he was an actor. Had some success at it as well. He was in a couple of movies in the early 50s, but a lot of actors really prefer working on stage rather than films. And if you don't break through in film, even in the 50s, going to Broadway and off Broadway was certainly the thing to do. And he had some success there. But, after several years of kicking around, the older you get, the less, likely it is that you're going to break through, into something. I guess you got to be realistic. I think he started taking, a harder look at production end of films and then got a little bit of experience. He got enough experience to go on and do his own movies.
Yeah, I'm sharing posters from the movies on my thread. And again, the more I'm looking into this, the more I'm listening to what you're sharing, the more intrigued I become. And now I want to rewatch the ones I've seen and see the ones I didn't see.
Yeah, and essentially we're talking about three films that he made, all with great exploitation titles, one of which actually was retitled. And we will talk about that in a minute. The first two movies that he did as a drive-in double bill. One was called The Horror of Party Beach. It's a film that maybe not that many people have seen, but I guarantee you most people have probably heard that title. And he made the second feature, which was called The Curse of the Living Corpse. Well, you know, those are pretty good titles. If you've got them, you know, out on your marquee, you know, out in front of the drive-in, that would make me pull off, you know, the road. And, you know, the movies themselves, actually, Curse of the Living Corpse, to tell you the truth, out of the three movies that Del Tenney made, that's probably the best one. It's mm-hmm. got the best talent in it. People who went on to have, you know, great careers, and there again, we'll talk about that in a bit. Since it was his second film, I think you can tell that he learned some mistakes. I mean, he learned from his mistakes in doing The Horror of Party Beach. It's overall, you know, the best of the three movies that he made. The third movie that he made but didn't really profit from in any way is one that most people know as I Eat Your Skin, which there again, that's a great exploitation title,
yes.
But that's not the title he gave the movie. He was going to title it either Voodoo Bloodbath or Zombie, or he had a couple of titles going. I don't think he'd hit upon that exploitation title he was really going for. He wasn't able to get that film released. He didn't want to make another film to go along with it. I think he was getting ready to wash his hands, you know, of film production, and he just wanted to get it into a package, you know, so there would be two movies on the bill. And he wasn't able to do it, and the film just sat on the shelf for about 6 or 7 years. And then another exploitation producer, whose name was fittingly named Jerry Gross, had a movie that actually is a pretty good horror film. I mean, it's cheap, but it's called I Drink Your Blood. It's not, there again, the title is more suggestive than the movie actually is. But I Drink Your Blood, it's got some places that are genuinely scary, even rewatching it. But it's a newer film, though, than I Eat Your Skin. And even though there's no skin eating in I Eat Your Skin, there again, that is sort of a triumph of the title over the actual product. But gosh, since I Eat Your Skin is a public domain movie, and I guess the background on that is Del Tenney sold Jerry Gross Zombie, I guess I should say, for about $40,000 or $45,000. It wasn't as much as he'd spent making it years before, but I guess, you know, to give you could write off part of it, you know. So he got a little something out of it. Well, Jerry Gross didn't, reapply for a copyright, so it went into public domain pretty early, you know, in its existence. And a lot of people, you know, horror hosts, even from the 80s, like Elvira, latched onto it because it didn't have a viable copyright. And that was my first viewing of I Eat Your Skin. It was on one of the Elvira VHS releases from, I think those were done early to mid 80s. You know, it was just when she was getting popular, and they got a lot of that into the rental stores back then. That was the first opportunity I had to watch I Eat Your Skin. And I quickly put it together that, you know, I had heard of The horror of Party Beach. It was a real struggle. You remember what it was like. It was hard to see some films that you'd always read about.
Yes.
But you couldn't, if you couldn't find them on broadcast to tape them, you know, it was kind of hard to find stuff like that. And when I was a teenager, I used to buy a lot of books about movies. And one of the books that I bought was Harry and Michael Medved's The 50 Worst Films of All Time. And it came out. I was probably, I mean, that book title, it's a fantastic book. If you've never picked it up before, give it a shot. I don't necessarily agree with their choices. I think that some of the movies they picked are actually better than what they say they are. But in the ensuing 43 years, there have been a ton more bad movies made. I'm not sure any of the ones profiled in that book that they released in 78 would even apply anymore. But one of those was The Horror of Party Beach. And I picked that book up when I was probably about 13 or so. And I sort of made it my life's work for a while to try to see all 50 of them. I had already seen a few. But I wanted to see the rest of them, and Horror Party Beach was one of them that I could never get my hands on. You know, I could just never find a really good copy of it. And finally, you know, years into VHS, you know, copies of it started popping up. And then Mystery Science Theater 3000 used it as one of their episodes after they had moved to the Sci-Fi Network. And it was a really popular episode, very well received. And suddenly, then it was easier to get copies of The Horror of Party Beach. But I wanted to – that was sort of my first exposure to Del Tenney, was reading, you know, the Medved's profile of The Horror of Party Beach. And, you know, it is a terrible movie. I mean, there's no dancing around it.
No,
I think it's done in earnest though. For some reason, in his movies, he dubs all of his female characters, and I've never been able to get anybody to understand. I've never been able to get anybody to tell me why. There is sync sound in some scenes in his movies, and some of it is dubbed. Just depending on whether the actor flubbed their lines or not. But the female in even the sync scenes is always dubbed, and I can't figure out why. I've asked that question of a lot of people over the years. Nobody seems to know a whole lot about Del Tenney. There's not a great deal of information on him, and I think that's a shame. You can find stuff on the internet, of course, but I think he maybe deserves that, you know, a book or something that I would never write, by the way. But I hope somebody is planning to write something like that, because I'd love to pick it up and read it. I'd like to. His movies are really fascinating in a way. Like I said, you know, the movie often doesn't deliver on the title. Part of getting people, you know, in the door is having a great poster or a fantastic exploitation title, which we don't seem to do anymore, except maybe the ones on the Sci-Fi Network, you know, Sharktopus and things like that. Those are, you know, ridiculous titles, but I love them, and they stick out. And it does make you want to watch those movies.
Yes, I got quite into Sharknado and watched a bunch of Sharknados just because the title was so absurd that I have to see what it was about.
I have to tell you, too, I like good movies as well as bad movies, but when I first watched Sharknado, I thought, gosh, you know, they could probably turn out four or five of these. I loved it. You know, it was a lot of fun. You know, it was tongue-in-cheek. It was a lot of fun. It was done with not a whole lot of money, but everybody in it seems to be doing their level best in it, you know. It's got some pretty impressive talent in it as well. And, you know, and then as the movies go on, you know, I have issues with sequels. Occasionally a sequel will even better the original, but most of the time it just degrades it, to tell you the truth. I think some topics really can be covered in a 90-minute movie, and then you just leave it alone. I understand wanting to, you know, go back to the well, you know, especially if a movie you know, it's been a blockbuster. I mean, I get it because that's just a license to print money. I understand that, but I think you ought to have some integrity too. You know, when you're trying to make it, try to make it better. Don't try to just lean on, you know, the first movie. Try to make it better.
Very, very, very true.
And you know, I like I said, I'm just not a big fan of sequels. I think with 99% of the movies out there, once you shoot the first movie, that's really it. You know, sometimes maybe two movies. And it used to be that only blockbusters got sequels. And then, you know, later on, even less expensive movies, but very well-received movies that made a lot of money, started getting sequels too. You know, like Friday the 13th and Halloween, which were initially, you know, fairly low-budget movies.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to, you know, keep things going for a while. And you know, some of them are more successful than others. I'm a big fan of that genre of film because it's sort of nostalgic for me. That's when I was, you know, a teenager. You know, a lot of that stuff was out. And right now I'm on vacation, and I am in an area where I used to live when I was a kid. I'm in the Saginaw Valley in a town called Frankenmuth. I didn't live in Frankenmuth, but I lived in the Saginaw Valley. And being around here just in the last 24 hours made me kind of nostalgic, you know, for adolescence, I suppose. And, you know, the cheap old horror movies, it was such a, you know, big thing for me when I was a kid, and being here kind of reminds me of all that. Unfortunately, there are no existing drive-ins in this area,
mm-hmm.
which that's such a shame, you know, but it's just the reality of the situation. A lot of those old drive-ins were in fantastic locations. They were usually located right outside of town, you know, and
yes.
It was a big parcel of land. It was fairly flat, which makes it, you know, quickly buildable if you want to slap a bunch of townhomes up, you know, or something like that. Now, you know, I've been on vacation now for more than a week, and I've found a couple of great drive-ins, one in Indiana and one in southern part of Michigan. I did post you know, one of the marquees on Facebook about a week ago or so of the Capri drive-in, and it's still operating, still looks good too. Everything is kept up. You know, the grass is mowed. Everything's painted. It looks like a nice place to go. And we also went to one in Auburn, Indiana, called the Auburn Garrett Drive-In. And I would tell you more about it, and I was going to post the marquee picture, but it was pouring rain.
Oh.
It was raining so hard, I could barely see, and I didn't want to get out of the car. So I just took a picture through the rain, and they don't look very good. I didn't want to post something that, you know, where the photo just didn't look very good. But all of this has really made me nostalgic for, you know, the things that I liked when I was a kid. And you know, a good horror film, I've always loved them, you know. Sometimes, you know, one that really scares you. You, as a child, you might have to watch through, you know, your fingers. You know?
Yes.
But still, you know, you weren't about to turn off the television or shy away. You wanted to see what happened. And all that's really created a sense of nostalgia for me. And kind of weird being here, you know, too. It's not the same place that it used to be at all. I still like the area, though. I was going to say that I don't really partake in a whole lot of nostalgia, but that's not true. If you look at my website, so that would make me a liar, wouldn't it? Maybe I am more nostalgic than I thought I was.
So some levels of nostalgia. I too am nostalgic for certain things, but in other things, no, I'm not. So it sounds like that's the same for you as well. But you are a nostalgic person, but maybe not in terms of the area where you grew up.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of nostalgic for the way it was because, you know, a lot of the towns in the Midwest, they, they once had a lot of manufacturing jobs and things like that. And I'm in the state of Michigan right now. So, you know, a lot of those you auto worker jobs just aren't here anymore. And they were really high paying for the time, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s. I mean, they paid their employees really well. And there's a lot of vestiges of mid-century here if you're into mid-century modern. So you can find a lot of existing drive-in restaurants and things. And the ones that were done really well, you know, with a lot of, you know, googie design and things like that, you can still find in pockets in the Midwest. And that's one of the reasons why I like to come up here every year. You can still see, you know, vestiges of Route 66 type, you know, roadside attractions, you know, really fun things. And it's I know it seems odd to some people to say, well, why are you vacationing in the Midwest? But there's really a lot to see. There's some great museums. And, you know, in a lot of the there's antique malls all over the, you know, they're just from end to end in the Midwest, starting in Ohio through Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and they're enormous. If you are a nostalgic person, you can walk into there and blow a good hour or two just staring at things, some of which, eerily enough, were like toys that I had when I was a kid. It's kind of frightening to see them in an antique mall, don't you think? and then they have all of these albums, and the ones that they are pushing right now, the ones that they're marketing, are all titles from the 70s and 80s. I mean, stuff that you and I, I'm sure.
Yes.
And I just keep thinking, gosh, you know, am I that old? Yeah. So I guess you're right. I am a very nostalgic person.
I like how the older movies, too, and they were way ahead of their time in terms of horror, like both Universal and Hammer created horror universes. You know, now everyone knows about the MCU and DCEU or the DCU, and everyone's trying to create these like universes where everything interacts. And Marvel has done it now with television and the movies, where the same characters and the same stories unfolding in different mediums. But it's actually quite old, and it started with the horror genre. And lately I've been wondering how big a thing was that even before Hammer and Universal, you know, people creating places where things happened and these movies were related to each other. Even with the Aliens got linked up with Predator, got linked up with Prometheus, it got linked up with what is that movie with Harrison Ford and the replicants? Blade Runner. So these are all part of the universe now, and their connections are becoming more and more apparent over time. I wonder if other more low-budget producers did that as well.
Well, you know, some of them did. You find a lot of it in, like, Eurospy. You see... You could see like the same, you know, Eurospy character in like three or four or five different movies, and that was based on, you know, the actor's popularity. And I think that, you know, you do find that with a lot of the Universal movies. I got to say, with the Universal movies, and I've got the Blu-ray set, the set that's been restored. Those are beautiful to watch. If you don't have that. Yes, it is just amazing. It transforms those movies. When I went back and watched those, Frankenstein's always been one of my favorite films. I can remember watching it when I was about 7 years old or so. For the first time, it was late on either a Friday or Saturday night. It was after like 11:30 or so. It was after the news, so it was very late in the evening. And I can remember watching it and just being terrified by the movie. And later on, as I got older, and then I saw Bride of Frankenstein, and you, in some ways, it's a fantastic film on its own. You know, It's a sequel, but in some ways it's maybe even more successful than the original. But after I went back and watched the restoration and I watched the original Frankenstein, I just kind of reverted back to it.
So, okay.
You know, and you, whenever you do stumble upon it, like the origin, you know, the beginning of something, that does become a serial. So, and if you latch on to that first film or that first book, you know, immediately, it's going to make you more critical of the ones to come.
Right.
You know, and so I do think that, you know, when you are, you know, facing a sequel, you know, like a part two or something like that, it really should be incumbent, you know, upon, you know, the production company, you know, the director, try to top yourself. You try to make it a little bit better. Try not to just, you know, rely on the strength and the popularity of the characters or the actor in it. And I think some directors do. I think some of them do. And I think others are just there to, you know, going back to the well, you know, getting a little more. I mean, I know things like that happen. And I don't see anything wrong with making money when you're making art. I don't have a problem with that at all. And, you know, getting back to Del Tenney, I don't think he had a problem with it either. Off the first two features that he directed, he made a ton of money. He made back 10 times, you know, the production costs on the film. So it made him a fairly wealthy person. And he later on went into real estate. He did very well for himself. He had homes in Connecticut and Florida. His film career didn't work out, but the man clearly had, you know, financial acumen. He was very, very astute businessman, very smart about that. And, you know, I think the economy in his films, but you'll probably show it. His films usually have nice settings, decent vehicles. It isn't some just, you know, clapped out old car. I mean, and there's several vehicles being shot, so he's obviously rented something. The sets look pretty good. They're all very modern. The actors that he employed, Curse of the Living Corpse, which is the movie that I think is probably his best movie, has a fantastic cast. It was Roy Scheider's first film. And, you know, Roy Scheider from Jaws and all that jazz. From the Seven Ups, that's one of my favorite movies. I love the Seven Ups. I love the car chase in it and the suspense. It's just fantastic. That's Roy Scheider's first film, though. So that's kind of cool.
That is cool.
Yeah, and Del Tenney's wife, Margot Hartman, is also one of the stars of Curse of the Living Corpse. And another favorite of mine, Candace Hillegoss. She is the heroine who sort of gets sucked into another reality in Carnival of Souls, which is one of my top 10 favorite movies.
That is a great movie.
Oh, I love it. I can't believe that, you know, something that good is public domain. I know it has, and it was done by Herc Harvey, who was a director of educational films for Centron. Centron made films for industry, and they made scholastic things as well. You know, sort of how to be neat, how to get a date, you know, how to act in social situations, you know, things for kids in public school. And they did a lot of training films for industries as well. But Herc Harvey was only able to make one movie, and then that was Carnival of Souls. And I think it's just brilliant. It's a shame he didn't have a little bit more money, you know, for the production. I'm sure he, you know, used what he had, you know, as well as he could. But it is shot brilliantly. And since he'd made so many educational films, he knew how to light things. You know, he knew how to get, you had to stage things, you had to get the shot that he wanted, how to get the angle just right, the lighting. Some of that is just so well done in Carnival of Souls. It looks like a much more expensive movie, and very cleverly done. just really keen eye for what he was going for and how to make it look even creepier. You did a very good job with it. It's just one of my favorite films. I've loved it ever since the first time I saw it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while. So now with that too, I want to revisit it. I'm looking
for
my
Criterion.
I'm
sorry.
I'm looking for my old Mills Creek collections. I'm sure I'll find these in there as well.
Well, you can find it, since it's public domain, you can find it on YouTube. Amazon Prime will have it. Archive.org, you know, my favorite, has Carnival of Souls. And you can go to the Herc Harvey page on my website, and you can watch Carnival of Souls there as well. I've got it loaded since it's public domain. And the nice thing about it is that it's a good copy. You know, some public domain movies, I think people get disheartened when they see them because the prints are in rough shape, the soundtrack's garbled. It's just the best of what you can find, which is a real shame. And nobody's ever going to clean them up. But Carnival of Souls is sort of one of those rare public domain films that has a really nice crystal clear print that you can watch. I have the Criterion Collection DVD, and there's so much information on that. You know, if you're a real junkie, you might try to pick up a used copy of it. And I think there's a Blu-ray. I think we have just the regular, the standard DVD version, but I think there's a Criterion Blu-ray of it too. That would probably be really the one to get.
Are you moving into 4K now? That's been replacing, like I see less and less DVDs and more 4Ks on the shelves and like Walmart,
yeah.
Kmart, and Target, and so forth.
I am not an early adopter of anything anymore.
Nor am I.
It's part of my age, you know. And my eyesight, I think, is still pretty good for my age, although close up, I can't see a thing. but from 5 feet away, I'm really good. I just don't think I could see enough difference for it to matter to me.
Right.
You know, I love technology, and I'm not technophobic at all. I think technology has really added a lot to my life, and I love being able to access a film, and just do it from my iPad, as opposed to having to go into the family room, look through all the titles, pull out the DVD, and then go back, to wherever I want to watch it. I love the convenience of all of that.
Yeah.
But I...
Me too.
Go
ahead.
But I just don't think that I'm going to be able to see much more of that much of a difference. I guess I would you'd really have to prove it to me on the 4K thing. And I'm not saying that it's not, worthy as being heralded as the best or anything like that. I just don't know that I could see it.
They've been showing since the VHS, when it toward the end of the VHS era, when DVDs were proliferating, they used to show you on VHS though what it would look like on DVD. And it's like, if you can show me this on VHS, why do you need to move to DVD? And DVD did the same thing with Blu-ray. When Blu-ray were coming out
right.
Before in HD, they would show you on DVD how marvelous it looks on HD or Blu-ray. And it's like, again, they have the technology already to make it look like that. So why evolve into a different form? Why not just give us better quality on the what we already have?
Well, but if you think about it, reselling entertainment to you, for example, when you were a kid, how many albums did you have originally as like an 8-track? Or a cassette, or maybe even the album, only to buy a better copy of it like 10 years later, and perhaps on CD, even at that.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a boon to some of the companies that own the rights to that.
You're right. That's true.
You know, I mean, let's say a favorite movie of yours. I don't know what your favorite film is, but you probably bought 3 or 4 copies of it over the years.
Yes,
I know
I did.
That I have. Yeah.
Me too.
Either seeking a better copy or just wanting to move to the next format, you know, going from VHS to DVD or DVD to Blu-ray or Blu-ray to wherever. I mean, I'm guilty of it. I've done it too. And I think it's a really clever way. It's a really clever marketing tool, I think, is to say, well, I know you've already bought this identical piece of entertainment or this art, but we have a version that has all this new information and all of these interviews. So you can, you know, there are hours and hours of documentaries and tons of excessive information, more than you ever want to know. And yeah, I'm going to buy it, you know, I'm going to upgrade. I've probably bought several copies of I Eat Your Skin over the years. As a matter of fact, going back to I'm sure I have. I bought the old Elvira I Eat Your Skin version of that film on VHS, sometime in the 80s. I loved, you know, watching her, and I had never seen the movie before, and, you know, bought it, brought it home, popped it in the VHS player, and loved the movie. And the copy of the movie, it was not great, so I went in search of better copies, and there are some pretty good copies out there of I Eat Your Skin. If you go the DVD route, everything that I find streaming all looks pretty much the same. It's not a horrible print. It's watchable, but it's not very sharp. It's not very, it could be clearer. Yeah, it could be sharper, but it is public domain, and it is the movie of the day today at Brian's Driving Theater.
That is awesome. I will post a link to that as well.
Yeah, the main actor in it, his name was William Joyce. He portrays this novelist, and sort of, it's not Euro spy, but it's getting close. They've clearly borrowed some James Bond elements. You know, they've stolen a few things from Goldfinger. There's one scene that's almost shot for shot. It's the same. only just not as nice, you know. But very similar to it. Anyway, the lead actor was William Joyce. He'd been a character actor for a while, and if you watch a lot of MeTV like I do, he pops up on tons of 60s and 70s television shows like Cannon, Barnaby Jones, Mannix, things of that nature. I think he was even on a couple of soap operas. Sadly, passed away a little over 20 years ago. But a pretty good actor, you know, and very watchable. And you see him, you know, in a lot of good roles. He's in the very first episode of Cannon, which is kind of neat. And he's the victim, which is even better. in a film or a TV show, if you can't be the killer, be the victim, right? I mean, people are only going to remember two people, you know, the two actors or the two characters, I guess I should say. The cast in I Eat Your Skin, of the people in it, William Joyce is the only one who really had much of a career, beyond the production of that film. It was shot in Florida, around the Miami Beach and Key Biscayne area. The production didn't go very well. It was supposed to be put into a pool of 20th Century Fox B-movies, essentially, and it was going to be released as in a double feature. So he had to use Del Taney had to use union workers, and he seemed to have some trouble with the union while he was making the movie. I Eat Your Skin ran over budget and over time. He usually spent about 2 weeks making a movie. It took an extra week for him to do I Eat Your Skin. And he didn't, in interviews, he didn't seem to be ashamed of the film or anything like that. But I don't think he appreciated it as much as I do. He said it didn't turn out as well as he had wanted. I think the film's a lot of fun. I really do. The special effects are horrible, though, for I Eat Your Skin. The zombies who don't eat anybody's skin, but the zombies that are in it, they've just got some sort of papier-mâché crap on their face. I don't know. It's ridiculous. And there's a lot of the one thing about these movies that I hope people remember is that they were from a certain time. I'm not saying that excuses, any kind of cultural deprecation or anything like that. But there are some culturally insensitive things that pop up in older films, and in Tenney's movies, you will see that from time to time. And it's just a sad reminder of not that long ago how hopefully different things were than they are now.
Did he appear in I Eat Your Skin? Because he was in the Curse for the Living Corpse. As the living corpse, and he was in the horror Party Beach as a gas station.
Yeah, he's the gas station jockey. Yeah.
Did he appear also in Your Skin somewhere?
Not to my knowledge. I don't recall seeing him, and I've seen that movie, golly, probably 1,000 times. In the copy that is of the public domain, no, I don't recall having seen him in. In the actual film. Now, the film could have been cut up a little bit. I wouldn't think that the producer would want to cut anything out of a second feature. Usually, they're trying to build it up. They're trying to stretch it out a little longer. But if they wanted something to be about 90 minutes long, I guess they could have edited something out. But to my knowledge, he doesn't appear in the movie. So it's not like an Alfred Hitchcock thing or anything like that. I think if he appeared in one of his films, it was because you didn't have to pay an actor.
That makes sense. Did he also make other movies? He has a filmography that's a little longer, and he made movies, for instance, Satan in High Heels.
Which is a great movie, by the way, and another fantastic exploitation title, and it's a good movie.
Did he make that one, or did he just act in it?
As far as I can remember, I think it's just an acting job for him.
Okay.
But he, he does a really good job. That's another one of those titles that I'd heard of long before I actually ever got to see the movie.
Me too.
And it was one of those, when something weird finally released it, I was, I was really happy. And there was a number of reasons I wanted to see it. For one reason, I knew by then that Del Tenney, the director of Horror Party Beach had an acting role in it, so I wanted to see it because of that. But I also wanted to see it because an actress named Grayson Hall is one of the main characters in it.
Dark Shadows.
She's Dr. Julia. Oh God,
Hoffman.
I can't remember her last name. Hoffman. Well,
yes.
Well, your memory is fantastic. I loved her on Dark Shadows. And she is, in some ways, she's even creepier than Barnabas, really. she's a fantastic actress. And she makes Satan in High Heels. She lights up every scene. And there again, it's another one of those something weird titles that are very accessible. You actually have no reason not to own a copy of it, and I do own a copy of it. I can't remember if I had that on VHS and then got the DVD or not. I think maybe I've just had the DVD. Like I said, technology has really helped in that if you want to see a film, it's not nearly as difficult or time-consuming, as it used to be. I can't tell you how many Saturdays I used to hunt through VHS stores places that did rentals for different titles. Probably wasted a lot of good time, but I think I enjoyed myself. I hope I did anyway. Kept me out of trouble.
Very true. I spend a lot of my time still looking in places for things. You know, that's one of my favorite pastimes. I love going to thrift stores. I love going to Goodwill, Salvation Armies, you know, all sorts of places like that. And whenever we pass one, I have to go inside. Because you find treasures there. You know, you never know what you're going to find there. Sometimes nothing, but other times, you know, it's like, oh, wow. You know, I didn't even know I'd ever stumble across this, you know, and there it is. For a few bucks, usually.
Well, we've, since we're in the Midwest and this area isn't as populated as it once was, we do hit those antique malls. And I generally am looking for movie memorabilia and old toys. That's why I go into the antique malls. And interestingly, I haven't found any movie memorabilia this year that I couldn't live without, although today I saw an original Fatty Arbuckle film poster. This thing was probably like 1917, 1918, beautiful colors. They wanted $1,900 for it, and there's no way I would pay that much for it. But
right.
It was such a beautiful – it was original, too. You could see the creases in it, and you could tell just from looking at the ink and the paper that it wasn't fake. I mean, it was an original. A beautiful piece of memorabilia, but I just haven't seen anything on this trip like that. No lobby cards that I was interested in. I saw a window card that I kind of liked, but I just haven't seen any of the movie memorabilia. But maybe I've mined it out.
Well, I hope you find some because you're traveling about the country, and so I'm sure you'll find some treasures if you haven't found some along the way.
No, well, to tell you the truth, we're in this tiny little Ford Mustang, so it's not like I have an SUV where I can, you know, haul a bunch of stuff back. It has a really small trunk, and we had to bring 2 weeks worth of stuff. So we don't have a whole lot of additional cargo space in this. So it's probably a good thing that I wasn't able to haul the original Fatty Arbuckle poster back because it was a huge piece. It was bigger than a one sheet. You know, it was not the 27x41. It was larger than that. It's huge. But it's beautiful though, in just amazing condition for a piece of paper that's over 100 years old. Just beautiful condition. I don't know. I just wonder who kept it like that, you know, for so long,
and why.
And who preserved it well enough to make sure that it didn't deteriorate. That's the real thing. You know, humidity, you know, does horrible things, you know, with memorabilia, you know, especially anything made out of paper, you know, it's horrible. And, you know, inks fade over time. Papers get brittle, you know, from drying out or from being too humid. But like I said, this thing was just beautifully preserved, just amazing, really nice piece. And you can find stuff like that, you know, if you go into places like Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, there's some amazing antique malls here. And in some of them, I'll go in and, you know, 2 hours later, I'm still looking at stuff. And others only take 5 or 10 minutes. You know, if it's not my thing, if it's not
right.
The type of thing that I'm looking for. If it's a bunch of Duncan Fife consoles, I'm probably going to walk out pretty quickly and just not. I don't want a 5,000-pound credenza.
Right.
You know what I mean? Unless it holds all of my stuff, then maybe.
Uh-huh.
then maybe we'll talk. But I'm not looking for furniture. I'm just looking for smalls. Like I said, movie memorabilia, old toys. you know, stuff that's pretty small and stuff that you can put away, you know, if you need to. You know, you don't have to have it displayed because it's so obnoxiously large or something like that.
And when is your journey finishing?
Sunday, actually. Yeah, I got to go back to reality on Sunday, but as you know, one more for the road. There's one more large antique mall in Ohio that we're going to hit as we drive back. It's in a town just below Toledo called Maumee, M-A-U-M-E-E. There's a river, you know, in Maumee called the Maumee River. It's an amazing antique store, and I'm kind of counting on them for a bit of movie memorabilia. So we'll see. They usually do have some great old toys. However, I rarely walk out of the antique mall in Maumee empty-handed. I usually have something.
When we lived in Pennsylvania in the Poconos, there were a lot of places like that, some in nearby towns. So it was always great because you can go anytime places. And, you know, so, some of them had like back areas that if they knew you, they'd let you in there, you know, where there were like tons of stuff that didn't fit on the shelves. And many a treasure would be found there as well. We don't have those in this part of New Jersey, although they were here when I was growing up, but they're not here any longer. There are very few mom and pop memorabilia or even bookstores anymore in this area.
Yeah, I miss bookstores, to tell you the truth. That used to be a good way to, let's say you had to kill an hour or so. That was a fantastic place to do it. You know, if you were out, if you're going to meet somebody later on, but you needed to, but you had like 30 or 40 minutes to spare, bookstores and record stores, places like Suncoast, were great places to kill time. And there's just nothing like that now. I will go off on my tangent about how terrible marketing is these days, but if you are out and about, I guess the only way you can really kill time is just to stare blankly into your phone. If you want to walk around, well, it's true though. If you want to walk around and look at something or maybe even educate yourself a little bit, it's kind of hard to do now. I just hate what's happened to commerce.
Yeah, it's I support local little bookstores, but the bigger chains, what I find myself doing is like, I like the way they're organized by category and you can see what's new or what's different. But then before I'll buy from there now, I'll check online first to see if I can get the book cheaper online. And it takes only a few days to get the book in most cases, although sometimes you might have to wait a while. It's stuck in some transfer facility. I try when I find these old bookstores to buy from them. But then my same logic doesn't apply to like the bigger stores that carry books.
One other place that I can kill some serious time and have while I've been on this vacation are record stores. They've really made a comeback. And even, you know, I live in a college town. We have a record store. Almost every college town does now. But even some of the smaller areas that we've been to have obviously thriving record stores. And I love going in them. Some of them also deal in older equipment as well. So they'll have some vintage speakers, amps, turntables, you name it, just a little bit of everything. And the stuff's been, you know, gone through, cleaned up, redone if necessary. So it all works really well. And, you know, they're playing the stuff that, you know, the albums that I bought, you know, 35 or 40 years ago. Those are great places to spend time too. My hotel is just about 200 feet away from one record store that I'm going to go to tomorrow. I'm really excited about it.
I'm excited for you. I hope you find many treasures or at least enough treasures where you could fit them in your car on your journey back.
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't really need anything. It's just sort of a browsing experience for me, you know, almost all the time. Quite honestly, I've got a ton of albums I need to get rid of. I've got every record that I've ever owned still.
Wow.
I've got, I know. I really That's need to awesome. Shed this stuff. No, it's terrible, actually. I don't know what to do with it. I'm never going to play it again. I'm long range. I'm trying to think of how I'm going to pare things down because we're looking to relocate. I don't want to drag, I don't want to drag my lifetime record collection with me. I'd like to just let it go, but I also don't want to dump it in a landfill. There's a lot of liberal guilt here, I guess.
I'm the same way.
What do you do? I never thought of myself as a pack rat, but I guess I am. My partner's laughing at me right now, so I guess I am a pack rat.
I'm a pack rat too. Unfortunately, we only have 4 minutes left for the show. I just looked at the clock again. It's like, where does the time go? Thank you for this. I shared the information while we were speaking on my timeline, and I tagged you. I'll share it in some of the Sword and Sandal groups after we get off the line. Enjoy the rest of your journey, and enjoy your welcome back to your home on Sunday. And I really enjoyed today, Brian. Thank you very much.
Well, fantastic, Hercules. It was great talking to you, and I look forward to talking to you again next month.
Thank you. And if you can kindly share your contact information, that'd be awesome.
Yes. Please see me on the web at briansdriveintheater.com. You can go into Bing, Yahoo, or Google and type in Brian's Drive-In Theater, and I'll pop up. If you want to indulge in social media, I'm most active on Facebook. So just go to facebook.com and search for Brian's Drive-In Theater.
Thanks again. Take care. And again, have an awesome rest of your vacation.
All right. Thank you, Hercules. Good evening.
Good evening. And thanks to everybody who tuned in, whether you called in, whether you clicked on a link on your computer, or whether you'll be joining us again later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we'll close with Golden Bough by Virginia Ackley.
The shade of the golden bough.